Welcome to the Performance Recipe Podcast with me, Richard Stewart, a performance nutritionist and personal trainer. We all know we can get tangled amongst the facts and fads on social media, and so the purpose of this podcast is to bridge the gap between science and practice by having industry experts on all topics performance related. I became a performance nutritionist because of my background in Michelin star restaurants and being a personal trainer, bridging the gap between food and fitness. I hope you enjoy the conversation. Welcome to episode 10 of the Performance Recipe Podcast. Next up is Eva Humphreys, a BANTS registered nutritionist. We discuss the importance of whole foods with a focus on nutrients as opposed to what foods to cut out of our diet.
Thank you so much for joining me on the Performance Recipe Podcast. Today we have Eva, is a nutritionist. And Eva is someone who I used to follow a lot on social media and became very much interested in the training and nutrition side of things. And she essentially inspired me to go into nutrition and training. She's helped me a lot once upon a time as well. When I moved from hospitality, that transition into personal training and nutrition. So it's a massive privilege to have you on today, Eva. So if you'd like to introduce yourself, that'd be amazing.
Thank you for having me here. So my name is Eva Humphreys. I'm a BANTS registered nutritionist, and I'm known for having a really realistic take on nutrition that entails the addition of nutrients rather than looking at what we need to cut out of our diet. And I really got into nutrition, quite a long time ago now. So I initially started training 11 years ago. I now have a master's in clinical nutrition on top of that. And when I first started in nutrition, I was just a little bit taken back by this idea of our nutrition messaging got really hijacked by dieting and then having these wonderful powders that would somehow miraculously achieve results. And actually, the vast majority of us are completely malnourished as far as nutrient intake is concerned. So it seemed really futile to me to then start cutting things out on top of that. So I thought, if there is anything I can do to change that messaging and get individuals eating a better diet, a better whole food-based diet, then I will do that. And now I try and break down the science into easy to understand nuggets, I suppose, and really just focus on things that genuinely matter and not about weight loss, but just about feeling incredible every single day.
Absolutely. That's why you call it the whole food warrior, which is awesome. I think so many people are focused so much on things like calories as opposed to the nutrient side of things. And that's something I would definitely want to talk about a little bit later on. Just keep people on a little bit of a cliffhanger, because some things are more important than calories, pretty much everything. So
yeah, pretty much everything. Agreed.
Especially when it comes to food. Okay, so just going to dive straight into the deep end and talk about some of the challenges that we find in nutrition. So what are some of the biggest challenges you personally have found in the field of nutrition today, especially with the world of information out there? So everyone thinks they're informed. Are they informed?
Actually, no one's informed. Not even me. And I say this really sincerely, because I don't think anyone really realizes how new nutrition science is. Our nutrition research is about 30 years old, and we are still trying to figure things out. And one of the biggest things that I learned only in the last couple of years is that we still haven't figured out how to help individuals live better longer. So if you think about, I'll tell you how I came about this, because I think it's a better explanation. So I started consulting into the care home industry, not an area that I knew particularly a lot about, but I thought, I'm invested in this. I'll have a look at the research that's available. And what I found is that over 65, the game of nutrition totally changes. Our life expectancy is 82 now-ish, depending on where you live and depending on whether you're male or female. But a healthy life expectancy is around 62. So we have this 20-year gap where we really figured out how to help people live to a really long age, but we haven't figured out how to allow individuals to live well for longer. So we've got this 20-year gap between life expectancy and healthy life expectancy. So I started drilling down into the research, and I was like, okay, well, why is this? Why is our understanding so limited? And what I found is a lot of really terribly done research where we are not coming to concrete conclusions. We basically don't really know what we're doing. We don't really know what we're doing with nutrition. So the only thing that we really have left is common sense. And I'm always dubious about over-supplementation or these wonderful new nutrients, or I say quote unquote nutrients because they're really not sometimes, but you know, these new compounds that are being thrown at us as individual things that work. Whereas the reality is that we don't know how they work and we don't know if they work. A lot of nutrition research is so new. We don't have any data in what that looks like in 20 years' time or 50 years' time for an individual. So I think our focus really has been diverted from having a good, really good baseline diet to wanting to do miracles with certain substances.
Yeah, so a lot of people will go onto social media and they will hear someone have a diet that works specifically for the individual, and that person will then promote that. And then if it doesn't work for others, or they end up promoting some sort of supplement every single time. And people are moving away from whole foods all the time. You look at meal deals now, and like I don't get meal deals. I did a post once on meal deals just because I just wanted to tick that box. But end of the day, I look at meal deals and things like Huel is a meal deal. And I know that you've had some things to say about things like Huel, but what's your opinion on people now moving away from whole foods and then going towards more the ultra processed foods as a primary part of their diet? And then is it ever okay to have these ultra processed foods? Is it always a context specific, or what's your opinion?
There's a lot of questions laid in there, so I'm going to try and answer them one
Yeah,
by
take your time.
one. Just going back on the Huel example, I think that's a really, really great one because, in all honesty, like if we could figure out how to live on a powder drink and it keep us in tip top condition, it would be wonderful, wouldn't it? Because it would be really affordable and we would be just done with it. But the reality is starkly different. And the comparison that I did online between Huel and chocolate milk, and chocolate milk actually ended up turning out to be more nutritious than Huel because Huel is full of ultra processed ingredients. And the reality is one, we don't know what the longer term impact of that is. But secondly, our body doesn't recognize ultra processed foods the same way that it recognizes food. So in food, we have vitamins and minerals, we have, you know, proteins, carbs, and fats, but we also have bioactive compounds. And what this is the piece that's really missing in our food picture is we don't really know what's in our food fully. So say like I'll give you an example of a garlic. You know, garlic contains lots of nutritional compounds, but there are about 2,500 different chemical compounds in garlic, as an example, and we know what 200 of them do. So what we try to do is we try to reduce nutrition into like vitamins and minerals and carbs and fats and protein. And it's not just that. There's all of these other compounds that we know are good for us. We know they're beneficial for us, but we just don't quite know why yet. And with a lot of these nutritional powders, what we're doing is we're reducing it back down to those vitamins, those minerals, the fats, carbs, and protein. And then we're drinking them. And I think like I don't know if you ever tried one. I tried one just to see. I'm a big believer in, you know, if I will try anything that my nutrition clients are exposed to, and I tried Huel and I was literally hungry half an hour later. Whereas if I had all of those vitamins and minerals from a meal, I probably would have been full for 3, 4, 5 hours. And I think perhaps that's what we're not looking at. We're so focused on this weight loss component. We're so focused on this reductionist approach that we're not looking at the bigger picture. We're not looking at what consuming Huel looks like later on in the day. And I can absolutely tell you it's going to increase cravings. That's what it's going to do. And then how good is our resolve to not give in to those cravings? Well, we pretty much know that it's not great. We pretty much know that at one point, if you have cravings, you're going to give in to them. So I think what we should be focusing on is to really go back and go, okay, well, how do I reduce cravings and how do I actually physically nourish my body? And it's always going to come back to real food, whole foods.
Yeah, so I think, tell me if I'm incorrect here, but basically, I have read some research where there was stating that, so everyone understands that you've got your different hunger hormones, and depending on what you eat, you can feel fuller for longer, so higher protein, higher fiber. But then, is there not other mechanisms whereby we associate fullness also with a lack of certain nutrients, so like calcium, zinc, vitamin D as well. So people are lacking these nutrients, thinking that, oh, I should just have more food, so more volume, lower calories, so high protein, high fiber. And sometimes that's just not enough. It's because you're literally just not having enough of certain nutrients, which is making you want to eat more. Is that true too?
It is absolutely, but I think nature maybe messed us up a little bit. So if we go back to before nutritionists even existed, or before we even had any idea about nutrition on the whole, I guess, we have these inbuilt mechanisms to search for food. So they reckon we actually have five different appetites. We have an appetite for calcium, which is really random because in the history of humanity, like when have you craved calcium? Like maybe beyond cheese, but that's a different matter. We have an appetite for salt, which was pretty much essential for our survival, and it was really hard to find. And I always think this is really hilarious because I'm like, what dude or chick like went out into nature and started licking rocks to figure out which one has salt in it? I don't know why, but that picture's always really hilarious in my head. We have an appetite for protein. We have one for carbohydrates, and then we also have one for fats. The problem is that any one of those appetites will look different in forms of cravings. So we only have two cravings, one for salt and one for sugar. That's it. So if you ever think about it, whenever you crave food, it's never been for a delicious salad. It's always been like crisps or chocolate or really quick sources of energy. So I think nature has unfortunately let us down ever so slightly because when you have a craving, it can be anything. Like it can be because you're low on nutrients. It can be because you're low in water. It can be because you're really stressed, because one of our inbuilt mechanisms for stress is to help calm ourselves down via over consuming carbs. I reference your Christmas dinner. It's like the ultimate way to calm down, right? Overeat when you're so full you literally cannot move. So I suppose like nature's really let us down in cravings being non-specific. I mean, it would be incredible if our body one day went, hey, you're really low on iron, like maybe consider eating high iron foods, or you're really low in magnesium. How about instead of just overeating toast, we consider magnesium containing foods, but it just really doesn't work that way. So the only real signal that we get is eat more, with the hope that by eating more that we'll obtain those nutrients. So yeah, slightly flawed. And I wish there was a better answer.
Yeah, like some people will go and have they say I'm lacking in energy, and oh, maybe I haven't slept enough, maybe I haven't had enough water, maybe I haven't had enough calories to sustain the exercise, been up on my feet all day. But then maybe you're missing iron and you're going and over consuming on foods, and one of the side effects, one of the symptoms of low iron is obviously being a bit more tired. So people not focusing on getting on the nutrients is not great. And I might be misquoting this, but I'm pretty sure I read somewhere, and I'll find it I'll find it, where they were saying on an average Western diet, for a female to reach 18 milligrams of iron a day, which is a recommended daily intake, they have to consume something around 3,000 calories. And I'm assuming that's probably because of ultra processed food is just such a massive part of our diet now, as opposed to looking at mainly whole foods and not knowing what type of foods to eat. So let's say we had a food plate in front of us, what would you advise to someone to eat on a daily basis? I'm not talking about performance, so people know me for like sports type nutrition, but for general health, like what does that need to look like?
Actually, before we get to that, I'm gonna just take a sidestep and ask you a question. If you think about chicken, what are you thinking about as a foodstuff? Like, if you're like, I'm gonna
What?
have chicken tonight, what bit of chicken are you having?
Good. I know where you're going. Okay, cool. So, chicken breast, chicken thigh. That's it. Most of the time, drumsticks maybe, but chicken breast. Most people within the gymming context, chicken breast.
Yeah. And I think that's maybe why we need to consume so much food in order to get more nutrients, is because we've reduced a chicken to just a chicken breast more often than not. I think like some people will have chicken thigh, and that's incredible. By the way, a lot of the nutrients are held there. But also in things like chicken liver, or previously we used to use an entire chicken, and that entire chicken will have a really wide variety of nutrients in different parts. But we used to eat everything, and now we go into the supermarket and we're probably not even associating a chicken breast with an actual chicken running around. I mean, arguably, a lot of those ones in the supermarkets are not running around, or at least not for very long anyway. But by reducing our consumption of chicken, or understanding chicken as just chicken breast, we're really taking out those nutrients from our diet. So one of the things that I often do with my clients is to look at nutrient density and dietary diversity. So it's two different concepts. So nutrient density is how nutritious can we make your diet? Like, how many different nutrients can we put into your diet? And then dietary diversity is looking at consuming lots of different things. And the idea is, say a pepper is super high in vitamin C, and an avocado will be really high in vitamin E. So by consuming lots of different things, we hit more nutrients by and large. And I think we need to apply the exact same notion to meat protein. So we shouldn't really just be focusing on eating chicken breast. Like, we should be going, okay, what about chicken livers? Or what about having chicken thigh as an alternative? And looking at what that looks like in a week. Because even by swapping one chicken meal to chicken thigh instead of chicken breast, you're automatically increasing the amount of iron you're getting, you're automatically increasing the amount of minerals you're getting. So you can shift towards that. To answer the question about daily food intake on the whole, you know what? This is a really hard one to answer, because by and large, you just have a very individual approach to nutrition. What I need nutritionally will be different to what you need nutritionally. And the biggest question that we should be asking as a consumer is, what do I need as a person? I think if we ask the question of what do I need as an individual, we would probably do away with a lot of the social media advice, because you're probably looking at a 20-year-old chick eating avocado on toast. And if you're a 45-year-old female, your nutrient requirements are vastly different. So one of the things I do try and do along the lines of dietary diversity and nutrient density is to look at plates of food. And look at the ratios on that plates of food specifically. So what I tend to look at is if we're looking at a plate of food, roughly for about half of it to be veg, a quarter to be carbs, and a quarter to be protein. But again, there are variations in that depending on what you need as an individual. Like, if you're a runner, of course you're going to need more carbs. If you're sitting in front of a computer all day, which a lot of us really are, then those ratios probably stand up. But if we really drill down into why those ratios exist, the half veg part is predominantly where all our vitamins and minerals are going to come from. So, your vitamin C, your vitamin A, like all of those different things. The quarter of your plate as protein will take care of your protein requirement. And then the carbohydrates are really for energy and fiber. And I'm not saying that this is achievable straight away, because honestly, it's not. But it's more about you as an individual asking the question of, well, how can I shift towards that a little bit better? Because it's all about increasing that nutrient intake.
Yeah, the color of the rainbow in fruit and veg every day, right? And then obviously people know a lot about macronutrients, specifically carbohydrates, fats, and protein. Now, obviously we've spoken a lot now about micronutrients and how they obviously are vital for our health and even performance to an extent, because people don't realize, like, even timing your iron around your exercise can actually help with the oxygen uptake. Having beetroot high in nitrates reduces the oxygen cost of exercise. So it's not just about carbohydrates, fats, and proteins. So can you maybe differentiate between macronutrients and micronutrients anyway, and explain if one or the other is maybe more important, or is it, yeah, elaborate on that for me instead.
I mean, it's all important. So for just to do a little recap, macronutrients are fats, carbs, and proteins. They all have a point to them, and it's macro because that's what the bulk of our diet should be based on. Protein, we need protein because basically the human body is an unsophisticated blob of protein, but with a bit of fat around it. I think we give the human body too much kudos sometimes, but really it's quite a simple thing. And so we need fats and protein and carbohydrates for more structural reasons. And then the micronutrients, which are our vitamins and minerals, we need those to almost hold the structural elements together. So for I always like to think about it as like if protein is the building block of the human body, then vitamin C and zinc and magnesium and all those different things are the mortar that hold the bricks together effectively. So we need vitamins and minerals in smaller quantities, but they are essential in the way that the body functions. And then we need macronutrients in bigger quantities for obvious reasons, because we are basically structurally that. Does that answer your question?
It does, yeah, completely. I just want to make sure people actually understand that for sure, because the amount of misinformation, and also being a coach, it's absolutely mind-blowing how the lack of education people have around nutrition. And even I think people really overcomplicate things. I have clients coming to me being like, oh my God, I picked up a kilogram overnight. It's like,
Of water.
what? Yeah, I was just like, what? Why are you upset? It's fine, let's talk about this. And I'm like, what did you have for dinner last night? And they'll say, like, I don't know, a big bowl of pasta. And I'm like, okay, cool, that's fine. And it's just water anyway. And they're like, no, it's gone up by a kilogram. Like, you can't have a kilogram of water. Then explaining them the carb to water ratio and how your body, there's intracellular and hydration. And trying to explain to them that it's essentially 3,500 calories of energy is half a kilogram. You'd have to eat 7,000 calories above your maintenance for that to be a kilogram. Let's explain sometimes. You have to explain things in a mathematical way for people to understand, and just trying to make it as simple as possible, because a lot of the stuff can come across as relatively confusing. So that's why I just want to make sure that people actually understand definitely what we're talking about here.
Yes, it's important.
Yeah, like it's yeah, because people come to me and they say to me that it's so confusing about what's going on in nutrition. It's so complicated. It's gonna take me such a long time to learn. And I'm like, listen, all you need to have color of the rainbow in vegetables, 20 to 30 grams fiber, preferably. Enough, double your weight in protein. Enjoy at least, well, I always say a minimum of 20% of your overall calories coming from your unsaturated fats from fish and plants. I prefer people eating fish as a main source of protein compared to most meats, because people sometimes don't really like going for the meat for ethical reasons. But people tend to go more towards fish. So, like, fish is great, good fats, good protein, and creatine. But I don't know what your opinion is on that.
I like what you're saying. I think we really need to drill down into the quality of that protein source, because if you were to eat fish but you're eating farmed salmon, it's not an ideal scenario. So we really are forgetting to look at the quality of our protein sources, and it makes a huge difference. There's some really interesting research coming out from Newcastle University where they were comparing beef from regen farming, from organic farming, from conventional farming, and also looking at what those cows are eating, and then what the ratio of fats look like in a steak from those cows, as an example. I'm using like really random examples to like help illustrate. And what they found is that the fats are totally different in a cow that's been raised incredibly well with a really solid like whole diet, versus ones that are being kept indoors and are raised for dairy farming and are being fed soy. So we know the omega-3 content of meat that comes from organic or regen farmed animals is much higher. And the thing that has happened with our diet on the whole is that those omega-3 fats, those essential fats, are being depleted, and it's making us feel awful. We definitely do need more omega-3 fats. One of the areas omega-3s come from is fish. So again, like going back to your point, it's great because we do need these omega-3s. I don't know anyone really that's getting enough omega-3s from their diet alone currently. It's quite hard to get the right ratios of it because of how our diets have changed over the years. But you've also got to look at the upshot. So if, say, for example, playing devil's advocate here, if you were to get all of your protein source from salmon alone, from farm salmon, your toxin intake would be so high, those toxins would be physically pulling nutrients out of your system. And that other side of the equation is something that no one is looking at. I mean, what does it look like if we eat vegetables covered in pesticides? Well, what that looks like is our liver has to detox those pesticides. And in order for us to detox those pesticides, we're using nutrients. So then we're still ending up in this like minus despite eating an okay diet. So I would always emphasize the quality of the diet makes a real difference. Switching to organic as much as we feasibly can, like I know it's more expensive, but looking at a better quality diet will nourish you more than not. So I think that's maybe the trade-off there.
Yeah, and I think so again, as a, speaking as a coach, people come to me and they say, like, listen, I can't afford this, this is really expensive. And then I break it down into how many pints they have on a weekend, or how much they go spend out on, I don't know what, like I said, I'm gonna say quote unquote junk food. And I'm like, how much is that you how much of that are you spending every single day over consuming of foods or alcohol, and break it down and then look at your coaching, which one's going to benefit you more. And I think, like, I remember when I worked in hospitality and some of the guys who would be like, I don't know, I bought something which was relatively expensive, and the chef said to me, like, why are you like, geez, you must have so much like leftover money. And I was like, well, you guys are spending 40 50 quid on a bottle of wine every single Saturday night at the end of your shift. And it's like, it's about, it's you choose your evil or whatever, and I choose mine. And yeah, I think people need to start prioritizing their health a little bit better, and you'll be amazed at what you can accomplish with better energy, better clarity of your mind. Yeah, and just feeling stronger, physically healthier, and the people around you start to feed off that too, and they start to see how much you have make a change, and it's an amazing knock-on effect. So I think even though it costs a little bit more, it's definitely worthwhile doing.
No, I'd honestly 100% agree. And I think what we're really underplaying is how much freedom being well buys you. Like, if you think about it, when you have more energy, like you said, when you have greater mental clarity, you get so much more out of life. Like, you really do. Versus in comparison to not having any energy to do anything, not feeling up to doing anything. And we're not putting enough emphasis on of thinking life in those terms. We're not thinking about making that investment for our health, because that investment allows us to get more out of life. We're just existing and hoping that our food is doing what it's supposed to do. And it's just worth paying attention to it, because like, what's the worst that can happen? Like, oh no, you get to not have a headache today, or oh no, you get to have a bit more energy today. Like, how awful. So we really need to think about investing in our well-being.
Yeah, because people a lot of the time look at the acute thing. So every research I've had so far on the podcast, or people I just have general conversations with, talk about protein timing or exercise, and they're like, people focus on the acute thing. So okay, today not gonna make a difference, but what happens after a week? What happens after a month? And you with their consistency, it's like the best way to explain it to people is like going to the gym. First day you go to the gym, you can have the greatest exercise program in the world. You do it for one day. And the rest of the week, months, whatever, you do next to nothing. You're not going to see any results. But if you're consistent, even if you're 80% consistent, you're going to see a significant difference in the space of 6 to 8 to 12 weeks. And it's like that with everything. You don't notice it straight away, but my God, when it you notice it eventually. And then but speaking about obviously all things nutrition, I think maybe there's nutrition specific protocols for different age groups, perhaps. And do you think maybe you can talk about that? Because obviously people know about and population and specific nutrition. So things like insulin resistance, what kind of things cause that? Then also talking about protein synthesis. So with older age, you become more resistant to protein synthesis. Do you think you can go into a little bit of that? And like, how do we combat that?
Sure. So I think you're really referring to aging when you're asking me about the different like nutrient requirements per age. And I think if we leave childhood out of it, because that's an intense time of growing, it really any time over age 40, things can't get better. So we need to in the body. So we need to really pay attention to what we're doing. But there's a really big I say jump off after age 65 in the way that we absorb nutrients. So this is an area that I've researched far too much recently. Probably, well, you can't really research it far too much, can you? But because of my work with high-end care homes, I had to look into aging in a lot of detail, down to micronutrient level and in a really, really nerdy amount of detail, may I add. The summary is that after age 65, we stop absorbing nutrients the same way that we have done before. Our digestive system becomes slower and our requirement for nutrients increases, not decreases. So you've got this trifecta of, well, okay, hang on a second. How do I get enough nutrients into my system? The one that is absolutely worth paying attention to is protein intake. And what I would emphasize here is that we really struggle to absorb protein from plant-based foods, especially after age 65. I often see this with my clients when they're like, "Well, I'm getting enough protein because this tin of beans says I'm getting 20 grams of protein from it." And I'm like, "Okay, but you haven't considered the digestibility and the bioavailability of that protein. And if we consider those factors, then you're getting 10 grams of protein of protein from that tin of beans. Over the age of 65, that might go as low as 5 grams because our capacity to derive protein from that tin of beans just reduces. So what my research has really pointed towards is that after age 65, animal protein makes more sense for absorption, for bioavailability, and for utilization. And I know this is a really controversial topic, but there is actually some really rigorous research for a change in this field. So we know that paying attention to protein makes a really large amount of sense. Weakness, especially muscle weakness, if we don't get enough protein in the long run, is really expensive to treat in the medical system, but it's really expensive from a quality of life perspective. Like if you imagine having sarcopenia or frailty, like what would your life look like if it was difficult for you to stand up from a chair? On a really rudimentary and basic level, it would totally ruin your life because it would mean that you'd need to be assisted all around. And that protein element cannot be overemphasized, or its importance cannot be overemphasized in preventing frailty and sarcopenia. So that was actually part of my dissertation for my master's,
Awesome.
looking at certain nutrients, frailty and sarcopenia. And it's so interesting. But I think overarchingly, we need to look at the quality of the protein source and we need to look at where that protein is coming from because not all proteins are equal, especially as the human body is emphasized. And then on the second component, after age 65, our absorption for all nutrients decreases, but we actually stop absorbing vitamin B12 from food. And vitamin B12 is needed to produce energy. So again, without energy, our quality of life really reduces. I am currently looking into the upshot of that. So what does that look like? Like, do we need long-term supplementation? How much does that reduce? But all indications say that after a while, we stop absorbing vitamin B12 from foods. They think we also are reduced in how much iron we can absorb from food later on. Vitamin D is always a problem anyway. So yeah, there's a lot of changes after 65. And I would also say, just because this sounds a little bit doom and gloomy, there's also a ton of opportunities for us to do it better. And I hope that in my lifetime, that's what we achieve. I hope that in my lifetime, we figure out how to close that 20-year gap between life expectancy and healthy life expectancy by doing things a lot better.
Definitely. I just want to make a point, and that is, so I would like you to define sarcopenia in a second, because a lot of people don't know what sarcopenia is. But what's absolutely terrifying is that there was a sarcopenia conference in the United States, and there's a guy by the name of Dr. Darren Candle. He's a world-leading researcher on creatine. And I was listening to him on a podcast, and he was saying that sarcopenia is now starting to be seen in even college volleyball athletes. That is unbelievably terrifying. That's a clear sign of lack of activity and malnourishment. So this is a really scary topic that people need to pay a lot more attention to, because I don't think people actually realize how vulnerable we all are, especially if we are sedentary people. So yeah, if you can just describe what sarcopenia is, just so people can understand how terrifying it actually is.
So I'll do both frailty and sarcopenia because they're slightly similar, but sarcopenia by and large is age-related loss of muscle mass and muscle function and also muscle strength. However, the age-related part is now becoming contentious, like you're describing. And one of the things that they think is happening is instead of muscle all being made of muscle cells, it's being infiltrated with fat. So instead of having just muscle cells within a muscle, we're getting a muscle cell and then a cell of fat. And as we know, that cell of fat is not functional. It's not making us stronger. It's just there. So we lose muscle function, we lose muscle strength, and we become really weak. And it is just a downhill spiral because we can't just look at muscle as just something for strength. Our metabolism also relies on it. The way that we function as humans also really relies on that. And again, I'd go back to that point of what difference would it make to you in life if you couldn't get out of a chair? Is that kind of level somewhere down the line? And then frailty is pretty much the same. So it's loss of strength and loss of function in the body. But whereas they only look at sarcopenia on a functional basis, so they'll look at your muscle mass. With frailty, what they're also looking at is subjective measures. So they're looking at going, well, how much do you get out of breath walking from one side of the room to the other, how difficult it is for you to get out of a chair, and how does that impact your life? So frailty is only really different in the way that they're measuring it. They're bringing in subjective measures, which I think is needed because it's all well and good your muscle reducing, but we really need to be looking at how that changes what your body is doing. Sometimes in the initial phases especially, we tend to compensate quite a lot, and then it's only later down the line. But if we just combine the two, it's degeneration. And it's degeneration being caused by not getting the right nutrients and not moving enough. And to me, that seems really silly because, again, like you want to make sure that you function really well as a human being and you have a really great quality of life for as long as you absolutely can. And we can change those parameters. The scary thing with sarcopenia and frailty is that there is no medication. So if you get to age 70 and all of a sudden you've wasted all your muscle and you can't get out of a chair, I mean, really extreme example, there is nothing to stop that. There's nothing to improve that. The only reliable factor is diet and exercise. That's it.
Yeah, exercise and nutrition. That's what it's all down, and it makes complete sense. The people, I think a lot of people realize, obviously, that's just a matter of fact that everyone, I think, just does recognize, and they realize that there's a massive problem, but people just don't know how to navigate all of it. And that's why having conversations like with yourself is so important, because I said this to Eva beforehand, but this is not just an educational platform, hopefully, for the general population, but also for myself, because every single person I've had a conversation with, I've learned something, and there's something that I ask questions, and I'm not afraid. If I make a mistake, I'm more than willing to be educated, because all of you are very specialized in your specific fields, and it's just nice hearing either confirmations or new points that I think everybody will definitely take something away, well, hopefully at least, and then come back and hopefully have a conversation with you or myself in order to help them. Maybe we'll see. But yeah, so what are the so we're talking about age, and now I want to talk maybe a little bit about cultural differences and maybe even ethnic differences. Like, do you find that certain people, certain ethnic groups will have to have a different sort of diet? So for example, I have a few Indian clients that have come to me, and they are predisposed to type 2 diabetes, and they look at it as a genetic thing, is what they're saying to me. And is that not maybe because lack of exercise, lack of protein intake, but a unbelievably high carbohydrate intake? I'd just like to hear your opinion on that. Is there differences, and should people seek out nutritionists based on like where they're actually from?
Just a quick break. If you find this information useful, please like, subscribe, and send this to a friend. Otherwise, let's get back to the conversation.
You make a good point. Genetics do come into it. for sure they come into it. We need to look at this realistically. What I would say though is that in this country specifically, we have really limited research for different ethnic groups. Because what tends to happen is a lot of nutrition research that we're doing is based on individuals volunteering. And by and large, it tends to be white middle class females that tend to volunteer for a lot of nutrition research. So our nutrition research is really skewed towards certain populations. And this is why we're saying to you that, you know, we think we've got a really good idea with research, but most of the time we don't, because who does that research apply to? What we do know from Bangladeshi populations is that disproportionately Bangladeshi men live fewer years in good health and are disproportionately impacted by cardiovascular disease and type 2 diabetes and various different parameters. And I do think that translates to other ethnic populations as well. So what we need to consider is then like, why is that happening? Is it culturally driven? Like, i.e., are there different celebrations? Like, well, you know, for us, Christmas is a really big time to overeat. So are those drivers for overeating or eating the wrong kinds of foods coming from somewhere cultural? The other impact of genetics, and like I'll go back to the genetic part because it makes sense, is that you got to think about it this way. Like genetics, or our genetics, our inbuilt genetics, are a combination of stuff we have to survive. And if at one point we had to survive long periods of starvation, we are predisposed to increasing our body fat very quickly, losing it a lot slower, but we get to survive. In an environment where we have food everywhere, and we really do, like, we are so fortunate to have the amount of food available to us that we really do, that becomes problematic because what your body is saying is actually, I'm used to having periods when I'm not eating at all, but now there is all this food and I want to fill up on this food because I don't know when I'm going to have to go through that period of starvation again. So your genetics can set you up, but how do you work with that? And what is there exactly? And those, I suppose, it's called one of the ones is called a thrifty gene, and that's what predisposes you to like hold on to body fat and to hold on to. And it's not just body fat, by the way. You also hold on to toxins more efficiently, which is zero use to us in modern times. So this thrifty gene, you would typically see it in individuals who a generation ago had starvation. So, say you're like your grandparents or your parents' generation, if they experienced food insecurity at any point, then you are more likely to have this thrifty gene and hold on to body fat more and be predisposed to type 2 diabetes more. But again, we're still trying to figure out what all of our genes mean. We only really know a few percent of what they do. And there's some really good examples of the ones we do know. But also, having the genes is one thing. What those genes are doing is a totally different thing. Because sometimes we have the genes for everything, but it doesn't mean that those genes like come to fruition. So it's called genetics, which is what, you know, your body's made up of, and then epigenetics, which is the environmental impact on those genes. And now this epigenetic field is this really big growing area where we're trying to figure out, well, okay, if I am Bangladeshi and I'm in the UK with all this food around me, what does that look like to me as an individual? Like, will it manifest into type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular disease, or can I dodge that in any way? And if I want to dodge it, what do I need to do? So, yeah.
Yeah, it's complicated.
Honestly, it really is. It's complicated and it's simple. Like the simplicity of it is if we focus more on whole foods and less on junk foods, things get better. But if you want to really drill down into individual differences and look at why is your body functioning in a particular capacity, then looking at genetics can be helpful in certain regards.
So essentially stick to your whole foods and you should be fine. Because a lot of people obviously they find it difficult to not have things like chocolates and sweets and I like you phrased it so well. So you did a cooking thing in West Bridgford not too long ago. And I loved what you said. You said, I'm not here to tell you to stop eating cookies and cakes. I'm here to not take anything out of your diet, but want you to add to your diet instead. And I think that is like such a good point to make. And I actually made a post a few days ago when I was in Paris and looking at all the delicious pastries. And I literally quoted you, actually. I should actually tag you in that. And yeah, like I think that's such an important aspect that people tend to just forget. Coaches as well, people don't, personal trainers have no idea how much influence they have on a person's life. And they've got a 12-week qualification. It's actually terrifying. And the nutrition is proteins and calories, and that's pretty much it. And I think every single personal trainer needs to do another qualification in order to give proper advice. Otherwise, they don't realize how much damage they're actually giving, doing even. So yeah, can you just emphasize what you mean by that? And like so I work a lot of the time like on an 80-20 sort of diet just to make it more sustainable for people. 80% whole foods, 20% sure heavy cookies and ice creams and stuff like that. But yeah, give me your advice on that so other people can have an opinion.
Honestly, I think it's a really good rule of thumb, and I'm sure I'm speaking for everyone when I say this. Whenever you go on a diet, the only thing you ever focus on is the things that you can't have. And what we need to do is just flip that switch and add in all the good stuff first. So think about how you can nourish your body instead of worrying about what a bad food is or a good food is, because honestly, that doesn't really exist. What I would love to see individuals do is remember that plate that I talked to you about. So it's like half veg, quarter carbs, quarter protein. Just to look at your food intake in a day and go, okay, how am I doing today? How many vegetables have I realistically had today? Am I on absolutely zero because I started my day on a bowl of cereal and then at lunch I had a cheese sandwich? Or am I doing okay with veggies, but I'm not doing so particularly great on the protein side? And by switching that mentality into going, what do I need? Like, what do I need more of? It becomes easier than going, oh, I can't have chocolate today because I've been bad. Like that doesn't serve anybody. What really will serve us is to add in those nutrients, because that's the bit that really helps us feel incredible.
Absolutely, 100%. And then obviously people hear about all the different types of diets as well. So obviously what we're talking about, I think, is what we call flexible dieting. I don't think it's a diet at all. I think it's a way of life. But then obviously there are diet trends like keto, paleo, plant-based. And now that's another thing I want to talk about a little bit before we start talking about things like calories, because I definitely want to talk about calories with you. And that is, what are your thoughts on them? Are there benefits? Are there associated risks with them? Because carnivore is a massive one at the moment. I'd just like to hear a little bit of your opinion on those.
It's, you know what? Second to looking at the plate scenario, the second question I always get my clients to ask is, does this apply to me? Just go back to your chick, like 20-year-old chick in yoga pants eating avocado on toast. Like, will that diet apply to you? If you're looking at Liver King, who's, juiced up to the max on every performance-enhancing drug known to man, is having a carnivore diet or a diet similar to that guy going to benefit you? Like, can you relate? Are you that dude? Or are you a 25-year-old woman, thinking that the carnivore diet is going to be the best for you? I think if we look at the scientific research alone, what we know with those diets is that in short phases, they may have a benefit to the right person. So, say, for example, the keto diet is beautifully researched for depression. So they think that actually it can help individuals with depression because the fats help to feed the brain a little bit better. It helps you focus a little bit better. So in certain circumstances, that works. If an individual has just been eating grains their entire life and then they go, okay, well, paleo introduces vegetables and protein and all of these different nutrients that you're missing, you probably are going to feel much better on it. Same with a plant-based diet. If you've been eating a really terrible diet for the majority of your life, and then all of a sudden you're flooding your system with a lot of vegetables, in the initial phase, you're going to feel better. But the question we're not asking is, what does that look like longer term? And some of that research is now emerging, and we're going longer term, it's looking like keto might have some downsides. It's looking like being purely on a carnivore diet might have some downsides. But it's worth acknowledging that there are always going to be outliers in that scenario. Because when we're doing research, we're looking at what applies to most people. But there are going to be people that sit outside of that. There's going to be the extremists. So they might be, five people that will do incredibly well on the plant-based diet, and there'll be five people that will do incredibly well on a carnivore diet, but 80 people will do terribly on either of them. So it is so confusing because, like, how do you even figure out what the way forward is? How do you figure out what is applicable to you? And I guess that's where really working with a professional can come in, because someone can look at you objectively and go, okay, you're missing all of these things. You're low on all of these nutrients. Let's do a bit of testing. Let's figure out what's going on, and let's figure out why you're waking up in the morning with brain fog. So, it can be hard to figure out what works for you, but by and large, the extremist diets only work for a really small subset of the population. And remember, social media is social media for a reason, right? All of these extreme things that you're seeing, it's a freak show. Like, effectively, it's a freak show because as humans, we're predisposed to paying attention to things that are not normal. We're predisposed to paying attention to these things that are totally unusual to us. So, of course, those extremist things will get more views.
Absolutely. And I think people tend to forget as well. So, for example, this is a bit of an extreme example, but someone might live to 102 smoking cigarettes every single day of their life and drinking a bottle of wine 3 times per day, as an extreme example. But all the people that didn't live that long are dead. So, you're not going to hear about them. So, these are this is what people need to realize. And yeah, it's all extremes. And yes, and having. Listening to social media, we become very much emotionally invested because it's our bodies, and there's nothing more important than our bodies. And I think getting a professional involved, if things do get bad, is going to give you an objective view, taking away from the emotion, and it just makes things a lot simpler. I have clients, like women, it's mainly females, if I'm honest, been on things like Weight Watchers their entire life, and then they're in their 40s and 50s, and it's like, I can't drop weight. Like, I only eat a lettuce leaf, and then I give them essentially like a sort of food guidance, a weekly course of them. And they're like, I'm eating so much food. I've never eaten this much food in my life. This is never going to work. This can't work. And then after a couple of weeks, they're like, oh my God, I can fit into my dress. Like, I don't have to only eat a lettuce leaf. And it's like, yeah, because you need to understand, like, there's no food is necessarily bad in isolation. It's just about dosage makes the poison, and like people having an education, having someone that understands how the human body works to an extent. Like you said, there's always something to learn. That's why we're having this conversation. So this is why this podcast's here. But having someone that actually can understand these things and give you an approach, and after 3 months, you might be able to just go off and do it by yourself for the rest of your life. Yeah, it's just start the process, and then once you started, got a baseline education. Things become a lot simpler. That's my opinion.
They do. And just to go back to PTs getting 3 weeks worth of training and then trying to figure out what the best diet is for someone else, I have been learning for 11 years and I feel like I know nothing about nutrition. So after 3 weeks, it's suppose you should really go pick who you're working with if you're working with someone,
Yeah.
and
Like
hope
I
that they know what is the
Yeah.
what the potential is.
Yeah, like I fully tell my clients, listen, I am based with sports nutrition. I'm not a medical nutritionist. If someone is, I don't know, struggling with something that I can't even make up right now, I will 100% refer them every single time. I've quite literally seen PTs watch a reel on Instagram and go, I'm gonna do that because I've got lots of views, and go mimic this thing. And I'm like, you have no idea what you're even talking about. How can you give this advice? So yeah, let's make sure we know where we're looking. And if someone is going out of their scope of practice, just ask them, okay, are you getting someone who's a physiotherapist telling you how many new, I don't know, giving you a diet plan? Like, that just because they've got the name doctor in their title doesn't mean they necessarily know what they're talking about. It's a very scary world that we live in when it comes to nutrition. People treat it like a religion as opposed to a science. Everyone has an opinion on it. But there is professionals. There's a lot that goes into it. There's, like you're saying, I'm learning stuff every single day. In this conversation, I'm learning things. And yeah, I want to learn so much more. But yeah, this is why we're having these conversations, and that's the research is forever being updated. Like, we thought we could only absorb something like 25 grams of protein until December 2 years ago. Now we've realized, like, oh, okay, maybe we can have over 100 grams. So we're always learning. And then, yeah, so moving on to this, the topic of calories. Now, we have things like metabolic adaptation, which I'd like you to maybe talk about a little bit. I've done a talk with you, actually. You did like a Zoom thing with a bunch of your clients, and I actually logged onto it, and it was super interesting. So I definitely recommend people listen to what you put out. And then if you can maybe talk a little bit about that, and then if calorie counting is effective for everyone, is it associated with eating disorders? What sort of context should calorie counting be involved in? Yeah, go for it.
I think calorie counting needs to not be used for the majority of the time. I'll take that back. There is only one clinical application where I'm like, it makes sense to count calories, and that's to keep people alive when they're in really extreme settings. So say, for example, you had an extreme car crash, or you're a really old person and you've just been admitted to intensive care. You know, for them to feed you through a tube, it makes complete sense to work out how much food you need based on calories. Or, you know, do a concrete calculation of how much protein you may need to keep you alive. In that context, for short periods of time, calorie counting makes complete sense. But I think calorie counting on the whole has done more bad than good for us. If we really go back to, you know, how it was even invented, it should have never been applied to food. So the prospect of calories initially came because they took a tiny little furnace, put food in the middle of it, lit it, and then they submersed that whole thing into a water bath. And then they measured how much that water increases in temperature. And that's what a calorie is. It's just a measure of energy. But that's working on the hypothetical that we can all use the energy in exactly the same way. And we now know that we really can't. So the example that I always use is if you were to eat a 100-gram bar of Dairy Milk chocolate, like we've all been there probably on a movie night every now and then, you would get 600 calories. If you were to eat 100 grams of almonds, that also contains 600 calories, but we only absorb 200. Our body is in this perfect furnace that's predisposed to just like burn whatever we put into it. We use those nutrients in a totally different capacity. And if we're thinking about ultra processed foods, a lot of that burning has already been done for us. So the moment that we eat it, we can derive all of the calories from it because it's probably so poor in nutrients in the first place. When we're eating whole foods, what tends to happen is the body just takes what it can or what it needs from that particular food. So in the case of almonds, what they've realized is a lot of the nutrients are bound to fiber within the almonds, and our digestive system is really lazy. So we only really take a small proportion of what's in there, and then the rest of it just gets passed through our system like fiber. Some of it feeds our gut microbes, but by and large, it, you know, comes out the other end. Actually, the studies that when they did the studies, they were really disgusting. They made people chew almonds and then spit them out again. And then also eat the almonds and then look at what that comes out like in the other end. So hats down to the poor scientists who had to go through that in-depth study of looking at both spit and poop. But also, I suppose, thank you. So we have that information now. So I guess the notion of calories really only matters if we're eating ultra-processed foods. And should we always be eating ultra-processed foods? Like, probably not, because you would just get really malnourished in the process of it. But when it comes to whole foods, we're not absorbing all of those calories anyway. So what's the point in trying to calculate them? Because how would you know? You know, to add to the confusion, if you had 100 grams of almonds, you might absorb 300 calories from it, and I might only absorb 150 calories. So how do you know as an individual how well your digestive system is working? You don't. The only thing we can do is look at dietary, like nutrient density, and go, are we eating the right foods to get all our nutrients, or are we not? And then I guess like the biggest example is if you were to have 2000 calories a day, which is the government recommended amount for most people, and you were to eat that from purely burgers and chips, very easy to do. You'd probably only need like one and a half or two. Would you necessarily be healthy? And the answer is probably no. Like, you're not going to feel great because you're missing a really large proportion of nutrients that the human body needs to function. So are calories just completely missold? 100%. Calories were never intended for health. They were just intended to ensure that we get enough food. But it doesn't really care if we're well by eating that food or if we're unwell. And I think now we owe it to ourselves to be well and to focus on that because we have got enough food around. We just need to decide what that looks like.
For sure. So there's obviously different pillars of health, I suppose. There's exercise, so you've got your cardio and your strength training, then you've got nutrients and calories has a part to play as well, because obviously, like you said, like in the hospital context. But people don't realize like your body is like with the gym. Let's say I'm gonna throw a few examples. So if you're doing a lateral raise and you end up shaking your body back and forth, your body's going to find the most efficient way in order to move that load because it's lazy. It wants to be efficient. So it's enough. This is why they say machines are so much better for things like hypertrophy. Then you've got things like our fuel sources. That's a physiology example. Then we've got the nutrition side, and we look at our fuel substrates. So when we're doing exercise, we have fat and carbohydrates, which are being used simultaneously, just at different rates depending on the longevity and intensity of the exercise. Protein is glucogenic. It causes an insulin-like response, I think. And then the thing is, people look at protein like, oh, but it turns into sugar, so it can fuel our exercise. But looking at that barbecue study where they had 100 grams of protein going in, it was less than 5% of that was actually used for energy. Then you look at the Dr. Alan Aragon did a breakdown in his research reviews, and he spoke about how inefficient protein is at a fuel source, to the point where your fat on your body derives pretty much completely from carbohydrates and fats and not protein. I'm not saying only have a protein diet, because people might listen to that and think like, oh my God, like I don't want any body fat. You need body fat. But yeah, like how to have 100 calories from pure protein versus 100 calories from a fat source or a sh pure sugar is going to be very, 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 very different. Because our body utilizes things in the most efficient way. And like you said, every single cell in our body, everything that you have been, everything that you are, and everything that you will be is protein. So it is all down to context, and that's where the calories has a massive fault. And then it's the fiber side of things, like you were talking about almonds, and then there's oats as well. And like even like 100 grams of oats is not going to be 100 grams, it might be something like 90 calories out of 100 calories or something. So yeah, the greater the variety, the greater the quantity of your foods, the more inaccurate it actually becomes. And then there's the other side. If we focus only on I know I'm asking you these questions, but it does tick me off a little bit too. And then people look at there's energy availability. So people always look at energy balance. So like for sports nutrition, we try to make sure the females have 45 calories per kilogram of their free fat mass in order to maintain regular physiological functions. This is with marathon runners, etc. We need to make sure they're fueling enough to make sure they can finish their races. Now, if you're solely basing things on calories and not just nutrients, and we don't understand these concepts, you can severely underfuel someone to the point where, well, your numbers are going to be completely inaccurate and they'll be dropping off weight too quickly. Like a rugby players, they have their match. Then the day that after their match, they'll go and drink like 20 pints and then they're smashed. And then the next day, they're hungover, lying in bed. And then at the end of the season, they don't understand like how they've dropped so much weight over this period, because rugby player needs like 6,000 to 8,000 calories in a single game. And that's 6,000 to 8,000 calories once or twice per week that they're not having because they're too hungover the next day. And they're going like, oh, but I eat so much. Why is this not happening? So there's so many different things that all of us need to like to consider. But yeah, anyway, like this is why I wanted to bring you on, because I think should people start looking at moving away from calorie counting, and may like completely, even from the personal training industry, people are trying to go in a fat loss phase? Or do you think people need to definitely spend a lot more focus on on the nutrient side of their diet, and that will help them get to the composition that they want alongside exercise.
think dietary quality is always going to trump calorie counting. Because again, like what is within those calories? I genuinely feel that there's only a small percentage of the population that calorie counting would genuinely apply to. And athletics is an interesting one, but for most people probably listening to this, and most people out there, like what percentage of you are athletes? At which point is that small subset of information going to really apply to you, or will you get more out of your body by just focusing on the nutrients, more out of your body by focusing on the quality of what you're eating rather than the number that an app is giving you? I think also from, being female and having grown up during that time when being skinny was overly promoted to women, calorie counting was always the thing that they told us to do. Have a tiny body, be super slim, don't have too many calories. And we're not realizing what that's doing to long-term health. So, having that restriction, one of the biggest issues that we're seeing now is bone density going down in women because they over-dieted during their teens or they over-dieted in their early 20s. And we've got to look at the other side of calorie counting and realize the damage that it can do if we're restricting our nutrient intake too much. And I think that's more likely to happen with calorie counting than, somehow being overly nutritious or worrying about body fat. Like we really need to figure out how our bodies function best. And I don't think calorie counting is helping us on that quest.
Yeah, it's again bringing up the topic of the acute versus longevity. Focusing on the acute thing is not going to really get us anywhere. We need to focus on what is the long-term effects of all of this.
Yeah.
Obviously, we're running a little bit short on time now, so I'm going to go real quick. So, one, what is the most important piece of advice you would give someone looking to improve their overall health through nutrition? And do you see the role of technology in shaping the future of dietary health? And then that will be all my questions for you.
Okay, so biggest one, if we go back to our plate proportions, really easy to look at. So that half veg, quarter carbs, quarter protein, look at what that looks like during a day and then see, try and figure out where you are because by adjusting those ratios, adding a few more veggies, focusing on your protein intake, it will help you feel better. As far as technology is concerned, I really hope so. And I mean, we have come leaps and bounds with technology. I just hope that it goes in the right direction. Because I'm still seeing a lot of tech being very pro calories and it's just the wrong focus. But if we start swerving into nutrients a little bit more, I think it can really help. So we use the example of women needing so much iron and it's almost impossible to achieve that iron. I think if we had an app that said, today you only had 5 milligrams of iron, how about tomorrow you have a bit of chicken liver pate on like a piece of toast to improve your iron intake, I think it'd be really powerful that way. And it would probably help, prevent a lot of associated issues like having low mood or anxiety is one of the causes of low iron intake. And I hope that technology goes that way so it actually helps us rather than focuses on the restriction. I hope that it innovates because that's what it should be doing.
Yeah, definitely. Like, just I work with calories sometimes with my clients, but the only reason why I do it is because it's something that people understand. And then this is where the coaching part comes into play, where it's like you start off with the calories, and slowly but surely you're introducing them into fruits and vegetables and whatever else. So I have a guy who's two was 203 kilograms. He's dropped 20 kgs now,
Great.
and yeah, like over like 4 months or something, it's a massive amount. But if you had a look at his diet, then I'm saying like that's okay too. The average person would be like, Richard, what are you talking about? Like, this guy's food is like majority ultra processed, just having like little protein shakes and stuff. And it's just like, I don't want him to do that. But people need to take baby steps, and people need to understand like, slowly but surely, you'll get over this. This guy hadn't eaten a fruit in years, and I finally got him eating blueberries with some Greek yogurt. And then now he's eating half a plate of literally just lettuce leaves with a protein sauce and a carbohydrate sauce, which is some sort of starred potato thing, which I'd never seen before in my life. And I was like, that's cool. And I was like, well done, mate. Slowly, 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 baby steps. Is just jumping into the deep end is maybe not sustainable, but just start making the little changes now. And in 12 months' time, you can reverse 90% of your problems. Do you agree with that?
100% on the baby steps side. And when I say, that those plate proportions and moving closer to them, you've got to acknowledge where you are right now and tweak, like tweak up. So exactly what you said. It's just those introducing those little changes. Even if you have to pick on one meal a day, like say improving the nutrients that you get at your breakfast, it's still progress. It's about adding in.
Adding in, exactly. So, a massive thank you. I definitely want to get you on it again in the future, hopefully, with this podcast evolving into whatever it evolves into. But yeah, if you can tell people more about where they can find you, like email address, Instagram, because you do a lot of really good content. So I think that's quite valuable to realize. But yeah, go for it.
Thank you. No, thank you so much for having me. It's been great chatting. So my Instagram is Whole Food Warrior, like Whole Foods, and then the warriors that, used to fight things, except our biggest fight right now is to avoid the chocolate at the end of the supermarket aisle. So Whole Food Warrior, and then wholefoodwarrior.co.uk is my website. I do host talks probably every other month to every month, which I hope are valuable to everyone. But that's it.
Amazing. Awesome. Thank you for your time. It's very much appreciated. And I'll be in touch soon. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you found it useful, please share with a friend. They would also benefit from these talks. If you'd like to keep up with everything else I get up to, you can check out my Instagram at rich_performance_nutritionist. And feel free to drop me a message with your thoughts and feedback on this weekly chat so far.